Today at Reader's Corner, Washington Post sports writer Barry Zwerluga, author of The Grind, Inside Baseball's Endless Season. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Hot dogs and popcorn under the sweltering summer sun at a local ballpark is an image embedded into American culture. But for the players jogging into the dugout, sweat dripping from their caps, baseball is more than just America's pastime. It's their career, and it's a career unlike any other. With 162 regular season games in 185 days, Major League Baseball places unique demands on the players, their families, and those who work in a variety of roles to support the team. In The Grind, Inside Baseball's Endless Season, Washington Post sports writer Barry Zwerluga embeds himself in America's pastime. In short, evocative chapters, Mr. Zwerluga takes us into the dugout and into the homes and lives of the Washington Nationals organization, giving us a behind-the-scenes look at the toll the long season can take. On this Labor Day weekend, we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Barry Zwerluga. He is the national baseball writer for the Washington Post. He was previously the beat reporter for the Washington Nationals and later covered the Washington Redskins. He joins us from the studios at the Washington Post. Barry Zwerluga, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Bob, thanks for having me.
Well, Barry, you call it The Grind. Let's talk about that a little bit. You really, in your book, right out the outset, compare Major League Baseball to all the other sports that are out there. And let's just take the NFL. How does the schedule of the Major League Baseball stack up against the NFL?
You know, there's an odd thing about the origins of this book in that I had covered baseball for a while and then went off to cover the Redskins here in town. And I don't think the idea for a baseball book or this kind of baseball theme would have come about if I hadn't seen how different the NFL is. We know a lot about how violent it is and the physical toll football takes on players, and we're learning more about the lasting impact that that can have on their lives. But when they're in their prime, football players have 6 days off between performances. Their life is a crescendo building to each Sunday and their three-hour kind of public performance that is once a week. If they struggle in a practice on a Wednesday or a Thursday, we really have no way of knowing. We don't know whether that'll impact how they play on Sunday. A baseball player that goes 0 for 4 on a Wednesday night with three strikeouts and, you know, strands the tying run at third in the ninth, he's got to figure out a way to put that behind him, to correct whatever's going wrong, show up the next day and be put in that very same position again and try to figure out a way for the outcome to be different. The schedule can be kind of suffocating. And I know that athletes from other sports, including the NBA and the National Hockey League, when they sit down and really think about what a baseball player does in having no practice during the season and no kind of time to correct things, it really even makes them marvel at what they go through.
You know, I don't know how many people I've run into here in Boise who travel a lot, and they'll come back from a trip back east, and they'll talk about how, oh, man, you know, I didn't get into 11:30 last night, and boy, I'm really feel wiped out today. But they don't have to get up the following morning, report to the field, and play baseball that night. And I'm amazed when it comes just to the travel schedule. For example, the NFL, I mean, what are they doing, traveling for 7 or 8 games a year?
Yeah, 8 games, and they're typically one-night trips. You go in the night before and have your last meetings at a hotel and wake up that day, play the game, and then fly out immediately afterwards. Baseball, obviously, there are perks, and the travel is as comfortable as it possibly could be. These are chartered planes. They're staying in the best hotels. There are a lot of things that, you know, I think a lot of the reasons you don't hear a lot of these stories is because these guys making millions of dollars are hyper aware that any sort of, you know, pointing attention to the realities of their logistical challenges could seem like a complaint to the working man. And so, but if you strip away that part, there are regular arrivals at hotels at 3 and 4 in the morning with a game the next day. This has not gotten easier over time. There are fewer day games than there used to be. That has an impact on, I mean, the San Francisco Giants a couple times this year have played Sunday night games on the East Coast, one in New York and one in Washington, and flown back the next day to face a home game that night in San Francisco. Whatever money you're making or whatever the level of your travel, you can't say that doesn't have some sort of impact on your life and potentially your performance. It's part of the demands of the job, and the demands are very real.
So it wasn't always 162 games. Give us the story, a little bit of the history about what it was like earlier on in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody knows that with expansion in the 60s, it bumped from 154 games to 162 games, and that's where we used to have the asterisk with Roger Maris's home run record of 61, hit over 162 games. But there were, you know, when in the latter part of the 19th century, when professional baseball was just starting to get going, there was train travel between cities. There wasn't the immediacy of flight, so there were, you know, kind of the necessity of more days off. But they also, the way the schedule was constructed, would frequently have off days in the same city where, you know, the same two teams were playing. So those early seasons, we were talking about 70 or 80 games, about half as many as there are now, and that's just a completely different flow. It just was a much different demand on the player then as pro baseball was kind of getting going.
You probably can't walk into a bar near a ballpark without listening to a debate between two fans talking about the superstars of today versus the superstars of yesteryear. And, you know, is the superstar of today really better than the superstar of yesterday, the Ted Williams versus the Albert Pujols, you know, whoever you want to pick out? Should this issue of the games and the increasing numbers play a role in that debate? If you're going to really go into analytics and figure this out, do you have to factor in the number of games played?
Well, I'm not so sure about the number of games played. The eras that most of us would be talking about would essentially be the players who played 154 versus those who played 162. I do think the game has evolved in other ways. A lot of those old-timer debates that you hear in the bar near the ballpark, or I hear certainly in emails and folks who read, are, well, you know, back in my day, pitchers didn't need to come out after six innings, and what's this deal with we're using five relievers to get through two innings,
right,
and why
right.
is a lefty coming in to face a left-handed, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The specialist roles have kind of changed things, and now those specialists are frequently, you know, even the mediocre ones are guys who throw 95, 96 miles an hour. That has changed the game, I think, more than the schedule has, because the schedule, anybody who's playing the game over the last 40 years has dealt with some version of the same schedule.
Mm-hmm. Before we leave the travel issue, I want to address it in terms of how it affects families and players in AAA. And one of the things I got to thinking about after reading your book is that the Nationals AAA club is in Syracuse. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
And as a Mariners fan, I know that the AAA club is in Tacoma. Well, when these players are going back and forth, as you point out in your book, being sent down because they need some work at the plate, being sent up because there's an injury, in Seattle, it's a trip up I-5, not so much in Syracuse, and I would assume there are a majority of major league teams whose AAA club isn't as handy as Tacoma is to Seattle. That has to really add some strain, again, not just on the player, but more importantly on the family who has to figure out, what are we going to do now?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And if you think about that Tacoma-Seattle relationship, I mean, the logistics of a guy getting called up, for it to be an easy trip, you know, the Mariners have to be home and the Tacoma club has to be home, and then they could be there in an instant. If they're
good
on the
point.
Roads, there's some logistics involved.
Yeah.
But the family aspect of baseball is one that I was really kind of interested to explore, because I do think it's untold. And I think one of the reasons that it isn't heard about so much is because guys don't want to, you know, people kind of envision, well, if you're making $5 million a year, you can pay for all the nannies you want and you know, you have all this kind of institutional help. But that's not always the case for families that are trying to create a real sense of normalcy in a situation that's not at all normal. The minor league player I focused on was a guy named Tyler Moore, who's gone back and forth between the Nationals and their Syracuse affiliate several times over the last few years. And there's real kind of real life concerns about that. Not only is it your dream to play in the majors, but the opposite of that really is AAA baseball. One player told me, you know, this is the level where no one wants to be because so many of them have been to the majors. It's very easy to get in your head. Well, why am I not there? What do I have to do to get back? I need to be successful down here. The major league minimum salary is north of $500,000 a year. You get a prorated version of that every day you're in the majors. And a AAA player makes $12,000 or $14,000 a month for only 6 months. So there's a very kind of stark difference between the two that doesn't have to do only with bus trips versus chartered planes. It has a big impact on how your family lives, what you're able to provide for them, and how everything kind of works on a personal level.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and today I'm speaking with Washington Post sports writer Barry Zwerluga about his new book, The Grind, Inside Baseball's Endless Season. And you looked at this issue of the family through the life of a player's wife, Ian Desmond's wife, Chelsea. Tell us about them as a couple and what's left to Chelsea to deal with while Ian's off playing ball.
Yeah, you know, I thought that that was one of my favorite chapters to work on, again, because I think it peels back a layer that we haven't seen much of. Ian and Chelsea Desmond are a little bit of an odd couple in that they met in grade school and their courtship kind of continued when Ian was drafted out of high school and was in the minors. But Chelsea knows the struggle that it took for Ian to get to the majors better than anybody else because she was the one driving her beat up car behind the team bus from, you know, Lynchburg, Virginia to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina when they were in A-ball and trying to keep things together in that way. Once they got to the majors, and I say they because it really is kind of a team effort. You know, when I was reporting the story, they had two kids, 3 years and under. Chelsea was pregnant with their third, another son that was born last October. And they really try to make things as normal as possible and keep the family together as best as they can, to the extent that Chelsea spends spring training taking the kids' sleep times and shifting them in half-an-hour increments to a later time so that they're up at midnight, 11 p.m. and midnight, so that they can spend some time with their dad when he's done with work. And then as a family, they kind of sleep in. They get up and have more time with Ian before he goes to the ballpark, and then he's off at noon or 1 o'clock to begin another day at work. It's a small thing, but I think it offers a glimpse into this isn't a normal existence, and trying to raise kids with regular values, you know, most of these guys came up in working class families or what we would consider normal families. They don't want to have their kids' lives shaped by, you know, the amount of money that they make. So there's things that they do to kind of create that sense of normalcy that I think people would be surprised by.
So you talk about one baseball wife who decided to do something about this issue of how baseball families cope with this crazy schedule and the nature of the job. Tell us about what happened here.
So Lori Ankiel is the wife of Rick Ankiel, who was a longtime major league player most notably with the Cardinals and the Braves. He had a stint at the end of his career with the Nationals. He bounced around from club to club, so Lori knew exactly the challenges that went with a midseason trade and what happens when on July 31st your husband is traded from St. Louis to Atlanta. He has to be there the next day. He's got to report to work. The team needs his services as soon as they can have them. And it's left to the wife to pack up the rental home and get the dogs and the kids and the cars and all that kind of stuff and arrange all the logistics of getting to a new city. What do you know about the new city? You don't know anything. Where should we live? Who are the babysitters? What's the school situation? Are we staying there in the off season? Are we going to wherever our off season home is to kind of regroup and then positioning ourselves to get back with the ball player in whatever the new city is? So Lori Ankiel started a service that essentially hooked baseball players' wives up with a lot of logistical help in each major league city. Here's babysitters we trust. Here's kennels that we trust. You know, what's a good, what are good neighborhoods to live in? What's a good rental agency to work through? Stuff that there's no reason for fans to really know or care about it because they're, you know, they're interested in the player performing at the best he can be. But as Lori Ankiel pointed out, she's surprised that more clubs don't invest more time and effort into taking care of the wives and having their players' home life taken care of, because that's the way that they're going to get the best performance out of their player. If all those other worries are kind of stripped away and he knows that his family's kind of all set and comfortable in their new surroundings. Mm-hmm.
So you chose to approach this book by breaking it down almost by position. And again, you didn't cover all of them, but the minor leaguer, the reliever, the starter, the general manager, the glue, Rob McDonald, who's the operations manager. There wasn't a chapter on the manager. And I'm just wildly curious as to how Matt Williams managed to escape. In the acknowledgments, you point out the incredible cooperation you had from all of these folks who occupy the chapters you did cover. Can I assume that Matt Williams wasn't quite as cooperative?
No, you know, it was an odd situation. He was in the first year as a manager, not just in the big leagues, but really at any level. He had managed a little bit in Double A. And in thinking about the series of chapters and who the characters would be, that's obviously, it's an obvious one. But I felt like a guy in his first year would not represent the typical experience for a manager. And I wanted this book to be, it's based on the Nationals. Each character is a member of the Nationals organization. But I think anybody who reads it and is a fan of another team needs to know, and it's very easy to understand, that there's a corresponding character for the Dodgers and the Cubs and the Red Sox and the Yankees. These are kind of arbitrarily Nationals people. If Davey Johnson had been the manager still in 2014 when I reported this book, I almost certainly would have done a chapter on him, because he was a manager who knew the job inside and out. He had been with teams that were developing. He had been with pennant winners. He had won a World Series. I was concerned that the Matt Williams managerial experience would not be the typical experience. And I really wanted each of these characters to kind of be typical, kind of, you know, perfect examples of the you know, larger idea I was trying to tell.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Barry Zwierluga, the national baseball writer for The Washington Post and author of The Grind, Inside Baseball's Endless Season. So let's talk about the starter. You're watching a baseball game, and there's the guy who pitched yesterday, and he's leaning over the rail, and he's chewing, and he's talking to his buddies. And I'm thinking, boy, this guy's got a heck of a deal. He shows up every five or six games and pitches, and then he hangs out in the bullpen or hangs out in the dugout. What a deal. You add a little bit to that for those of us who think these guys are off all the time when they're not out on the mound.
Yeah, I think the best way to characterize it is that those four off days in between starts, just they're not off days. They're not what you would think they would be. Now, is there downtime? Absolutely, there's downtime. But in the way I wanted to structure that chapter, which happened to focus on Doug Fister, who was one of the Nationals starters last year, was to eliminate the stuff that happened in his starts and follow him from the time he walked off the mound and is taken out of the game in one start to the time he picked up the ball to throw the first pitch of the next start. And what you find is these guys are incredible creatures of habit, but there are also challenges, both mental and physical, in trying to prepare with that far in between. There's a certain challenge to the everyday player of trying to put behind that 0-for-4 and come back the next day and do it. The reverse of that is the starting pitcher, who may have a rough outing, have to sit on it for 4 or 5 days, have to figure out a way physically to work through whatever issues they're having. Is there a mechanical adjustment they want to make? They're looking at video. They're working with the pitching coach. Typically, they will look at video of, okay, let's find a start where I was at my very best. Let's look at me mechanically when I'm having success and compare it to what I did in my most recent start. And then there's a very fine line of, they usually throw off a mound once in between starts. you cannot overexert yourself. And Pfister talked about in the old days, he'd in his bullpen session, this between starts bullpen session, he would throw, you know, 60, 70, 80 pitches because he's trying so hard to work through whatever issue he has. Well, what he's found out was that had a direct impact on him physically for his actual performance in a few days. So there's a mental adjustment that has to be made to killing that time and using it wisely. There's a physical flushing of the system and then rebuilding the body so you can go back out there and do it again. And it's a much different experience than it is for the everyday player.
You also talk about the reliever, and my impression of the reliever has always been a guy who somewhere along in his career can't handle the long game, so they move him to the bullpen where he can come in as a reliever. In the Nationals' case, you showcase a reliever who was relieving from the time he was in college. Tell us about that and how common that is versus my impression.
Your impression isn't wrong. I mean, a lot of relievers are failed starters, and they have to make a huge mental adjustment to kind of being stripped of that role. You know, there's also a in their kind of starry-eyed approach to starting pitchers make more money, so there's have to adjust their career aspirations in that way. But the reliever I chose was Drew Storen. He's been a closer for the Nationals. He's excelled in that role. He's also been demoted from that role after playoff failures. And I thought he was a good example of everything that you could go through as a reliever, from being a lockdown closer and one of the best in the league to having to deal with failure. You know, if a starting pitcher gives up one run in the first inning, he's got six or seven innings to come back and kind of say, yo, I'm going to limit you right there. A reliever gives up one run, and that has a direct impact on the ball game. He doesn't have more chance to kind of lessen the impact of that. I also was kind of fascinated with the idea of these are really the only guys who come to the ballpark every day. And if you're a closer, you're either not going to perform at all, not be asked to do anything in the course of the game if your team is losing or if they're winning by a lot, or you're going to be put in the highest pressure situation trying to protect, you know, the one-run lead with Mike Trout and Albert Pujols coming up. So there's got to be a way that you handle that mentally, you know, even though the outcomes of your day could be completely different. And Drew Storen's approach was to treat every day absolutely the same, to the point where when he was at home, he ate the same meal at the same restaurant, Chipotle, every day, just to convince himself that, you know, regardless of whether he had saved 10 games in a row or given up a grand slam to lose the game the night before, that his approach was going to be the same, even though he had no idea how his day was going to go. I thought that was kind of an interesting way to go about your existence.
So you mentioned, or I mentioned earlier, that there wasn't a chapter there on the manager, and you explained why that was. There's another chapter that's missing in this book, and that's a chapter on the sports writer, yeah. the guy covering this game, and that would be you, Barry. Tell us about your life. First of all, you're not on the team plane.
Correct.
You're doing your own logistics when it comes to, I mean, obviously you probably have help back at the Washington Post, but I mean, that's got to be a grind as well.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have said that to you, and my writer friends have said you could have done a chapter on us. And just to be clear, I'm no longer the beat writer that covers the team for the Post day to day. I had that role for 4 years.
That was enough.
Several years ago. Well, it really is. It's a young person's game. Yeah. You are, most writers don't cover 162, but they will probably cover 140, 130 or 140 and have, it's at most papers and news outlets now. A Major League Baseball beat is at least a two-person job, because there's not only the logistics of getting to the games and you get there at 2:30 in the afternoon and clubhouse opens at 3:30 and you're talking to folks in the clubhouse and batting practice, and you're gathering your kind of pregame notes and whatever sort of news stories there are. So you're doing a lot of work, and then the game begins, and then you're there until midnight or sometimes 1 a.m., you know, filing your stories. And if it's getaway day and you had a night game, the players are flying ahead on their charter, and there are difficulties in getting in at 3 or 4 in the morning. But there's also difficulties in, you know, getting back to your hotel at 1 in the morning and having a 6:30 a.m. flight. So, again, not a complaint in any way, shape, or form, but it is the defining thing about the season that you know, you're spending a lot of hours around these guys and around this team and away from home, and you know, with the vast majority of games being night games, it's difficult to maintain normal social lives and kind of normal relations, because it's just not a normal way to go about things. Mm-hmm.
The last question is really a question I have about baseball in general. It's not necessarily about your book, but let's face it, you can look into the stands at any televised baseball game, and with some exceptions, there's a lot of empty seats. That's due in part to how slow the game is. It's due in part to the way people have picked up football instead of baseball as America's pastime. And the third one, I don't think you have to be xenophobic to make this observation, there's fewer Americans on the field and more Latins and Japanese and Koreans. And I know that the NCAA has even been approached at least once in its recent history by Major League Baseball regarding adding new scholarships to Division I baseball programs with the hopes of attracting more kids, American kids, African-American kids, where there's been a decline in the number of African-Americans on the field as well. Do you think Major League Baseball is currently concerned about this, or are they just going down this path of, well, baseball is going to be an international sport, and we're not going to worry about how much of an American pastime it is?
No, I think they're absolutely concerned. But I think you touched on a lot of pieces that you break off kind of individually and deal with that kind of make up the whole. First of all, the empty seats issue, that's not something they're concerned about. They are setting or nearly setting records on an annual basis in terms of how many people are coming to the ballpark. The reality is that in very few markets, while you can sell out an NFL stadium 8 times a year, you're asking a baseball stadium to be sold out on 81 occasions, and that's just not very realistic. Except for certain eras in a place like Boston with a small park, or St. Louis, where their fan base reaches so wide. Mm-hmm. That's not the concern. It's a $9 billion industry. The financial health of these franchises is generally very, very good. The concern is the pipeline issue that you raised. Are American kids engaging with baseball? Are they playing it? Do they love it? Do they turn on the TV? Do they, you know, play Little League? That's where they're at kind of a grassroots level. I think they're trying to take some steps to make sure they're shoring up their grassroots approaches, and that they've identified the best ways to get kids engaged. That leads to something you touched on in the pace of the game, the time it takes to play. Major League Baseball games are longer than they used to be. Some of that has to do with those specialty roles we talked about. There's more pitching changes. Players take more time. They addressed that last offseason, or at least started to, in putting some time constraints in between innings and making batters keep their foot in the batter's box in between pitches if they haven't fouled off a pitch. The pitcher has to be ready right at the beginning of when they come out of the commercial break. This had a pretty immediate impact. It might not sound like much, but midway through the season, average game times were down 9 or 10 minutes. That, over the course of a year, has an impact in how much time you're being asked to watch this stuff. So that's kind of a long-winded way of saying Major League Baseball is aware of all of those issues. They have people dealing with all of them. And I think they understand the challenges that they face in keeping the next generation of fans interested.
Good point. Very good answer. Barry, thanks so much for joining us today. Again, the name of this book, The Grind, Inside Baseball's Endless Season. The author is Barry Sverluga. Barry, we can't thank you enough for joining us today. Good luck covering the rest of the season.
Bob, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Barry Sverluga. Next week, David Brooks, author of The Road to Character, and the speaker September 27th for the Distinguished Lecture Series at Boise State. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Brady Moore. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. We invite you to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Find us by searching for Reader's Corner.